There's so much to this, and so we really focused on those early days when he was, you know, in Bethlehem, and the family took him to the temple, and then there were people that encountered him, and we focused on that. And then this week I thought, okay, well, we'll wrap it all up. And I got into the fact that they had to flee into Egypt, and there's just so much in that, particularly dealing with the sovereignty of God and how do we deal with the crises that happen in our life. So what that meant is that next week we'll finally get to when he's 12 years old. I always wanted to look at that because I think it says much to us, especially, you know, if we have children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews, and the role that God has in those lives, shaping them as they move into adulthood. And you see Jesus at 12 years, an amazing picture of this unique young man. So that's where we'll be next week. So because we're going back and forth in Matthew and Luke, there's this paper here has the scriptures, so it makes it easy for us. Then for the life groups, there is an article here that's called Trauma is Not a Life Sentence. I've already posted it on the website. So if you have access to a printer at home, you might want to consider just running that off. Or if you read a lot on your iPad, you could do that as well. Otherwise, they're here. I've made 20 copies. If we run out and you need one, just tell me. I'll go and make a copy for you. So that one is particularly good because, again, it ties into crises and how is God sovereign in that. Then the last piece, this here is also for the life groups this week because there's just not time to deal with it, but it's how God works sovereignly in what looks to be like disaster. And there's a passage from the scripture that's there and some questions that go along with that. So those are there for you to help yourself to it. So the question that deals with the coffee question, just about lost it there. But let me explain, too, because I just feel like we got to keep reminding why we have the coffee question time. We deliberately want to be a relationally sticky church. We never want it to happen that a person walks in here, walks out, and nobody talks to them. We just feel like we've got to be deliberate to do that. And so we provide this coffee question, and the idea is, the coffee question is that you don't talk to your best friend every week because you'll never meet anybody. So the idea is that the coffee question is you see, hey, I don't know that person. Go up, hey, I'm Jimmy. Hey, I'm Jimmy Bob. And then you talk about the coffee question, introduce yourself, and it provides a connection point. And that's one of the ways in which we want to help one another get to know each other. We also told the life group leaders yesterday, one of the best ways to meet people is don't sit in the same seat every week. What it's fun is that it creates this dynamic when you go and sit somewhere else and somebody comes in, oh, you're in my seat. And then they have to go and sit somewhere else and they go, oh, you're in my seat. But what happens is you sit around a different circle of people. And that's the way in which you get to meet one another, chat with one another, and through that, relationships begin to form. So the coffee question, Matthew, if you can put the slides up for me, is how do you understand God to be sovereign? It's very open, very vague. I'm deliberately not putting anything out there. We'll work through the text and begin to see specifically. But as you start, when you just, right off the top of your head, what does that mean to you? That God is sovereign. How do you understand him to be sovereign? And in which ways? At the other time, this is incredibly deep and philosophical, and if some of you are that way of thinking and you meet another deep philosophical person, go to it for 5 minutes. Go right down into the depths and pursue it. But other of you might just more on a general way begin to say, well, I understand God's sovereignty like this. There's two coffee stations, speed stick here up at the front, only coffee. And then at the back is coffee, tea, decaf coffee as well, and water. I'll call you back in about 5-6 minutes. Enjoy your conversations with one another. Mention about trauma is not a life sentence. So I'll reiterate, it is on the website. When you go to the website, to the teaching times, you look where the sermons are, select Christmas, and you will find them under Christmas as well. But if you want, if you don't have a printer at home, and you would like a hard copy of that, a paper copy, just speak to me afterwards. I will be happy to run a copy off for you before you leave. Or if you're in a rush, leave me your address and I'll get one over to you tomorrow. So in this thing, questioning, dealing with, wow, we got a rowdy bunch over here, Bernie. Yeah. No, I was just teasing them. I love to see people chatting together and talking. That's so important. So there are four things that we're really going to deal with this morning that comes out of this, the fact that the family had to flee to Egypt. And here are the four. First of all is this, the Jesus family had to run for their lives. And we'll work our way through. But these are the key four points. Second thing is that Jesus for a time lived as a refugee. Third thing is that Jesus as a child fulfilled what the Lord had said in advance about him. And that's very significant. And the fourth is this, that in the crisis of running for their lives, we see God still in control. And that's very, very important for you and I, the application. So the passage, and I'll refer to this because, and if you didn't get a chance, they're still up here. You're welcome to grab one. But the passage, because it makes it easier for going back and forth, out of Matthew chapter 2 and verse 7 to 12, this is just stepping back into the story so that we can move forward. It says, then Herod called the Magi secretly, and he found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. After they'd heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them, till it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Now, when the wise men show up in Jerusalem and they meet Herod, Herod, though he was shocked, he played the part really, really well. To all appearances, he was just as interested in finding this newborn king so he too could worship along with the wise men. The wise men were fooled, but God wasn't. God knew the heart of Herod. He knew what his intent was, and God intervened so that they didn't go back to Jerusalem, because they would have, but God intervened in a dream and told them to go home in a very different way. We press on in the story. It said that when they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother, just set that down, and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt. Now, God the Father could have sent an angel to stand outside of the house in Bethlehem and with these orders. If Herod's soldiers show up with the plan to kill the child, you know what to do. The question is, why didn't God do it that way? Why didn't God fight Herod? Why did he choose to tell Joseph, you got to get up and you need to run right now? What's significant is when you think of the ways in which human societies around the world, the way in which they deal with their enemies, more often than not, it's a military option that is pursued. And the armies of heaven were more than adequate to deal with Herod, Caesar, anyone else associated with them or who would have followed them. The fact is, it was not God's will to use might to crush evil. No one but the sovereign God, though he'd given hints of it in the Old Testament, no one knew that it would be by the suffering of the Messiah and his sacrifice of his life that this would be the way which evil would be overcome and undone. That wasn't obviously clear yet to people. And what we see in this is just as there was a right moment for the Messiah to be born, remember Galatians 4:4, in the fullness of time, God sent his Son. I want to remind you that in this incident, we also learn there was a fullness of time as to when Messiah would give his life. And that moment when Herod threatened, that was not the moment that God purposed his Son to be sacrificed. There's a second thing that deals with it, that Jesus for a time lived as a refugee. Now, when you read the text here, it reads as if it was the very next night, in the middle of the night, in a dream, that God spoke to Joseph and said, you need to get up and escape to Egypt. That's how it reads to me. Which tells me there was very little time to prepare. You know, sometimes when we go away on a trip, we, you know, my plan has always been, you know, I lay stuff when I go to Columbia. I'm laying stuff out on the bed so I can see it over the week to make sure I've got everything. Well, they didn't have time like that. And you know, maybe, you know, Mary didn't have time to make sandwiches for the trip. They had to go because no one could see them leaving, nor did they want anyone to see which direction they went in. Because you know that if Herod's soldiers had found out, they would have pursued after them. And so as a toddler, Jesus lived as a refugee. This so deeply impressed me this week as I thought about this. And I don't know if you've ever thought of his life in this way. They had to run for their life and live in another country for a season. Now on June 20th of the past year, the UN released this report. And the title of that says that an unprecedented 65 million people have been displaced by war and persecution in 2015. Don't know what the 2016 numbers are. But let me read you a couple excerpts from this article. It says, the number of people displaced from their homes due to conflict and persecution last year exceeded 60 million for the first time in the United Nations history. It's a number that's greater than the combined populations of the United Kingdom or the combined populations of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. The Global Trends 2015, compiled by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, notes that 65.3 million people were displaced at the end of 2015. That was an increase of 5 million from 59.5 million a year earlier. The tally comprises 21.3 million refugees, 3.2 million asylum seekers, and 40.8 million people internally displaced within their own country. When you measure that against the world's population of 7.4 billion, what that number means is that one in every 113 people globally are now a refugee, an asylum seeker, or internally displaced. And the UN says that this is putting the globe at a level of risk for which they know no precedent. Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia produce half the world's refugees. Syria at 4.9 million, Afghanistan at 2.7 million, Somalia at 1.1 million. I did not know this about Colombia, but Colombia has the largest number of internally displaced people in the world, at 6.9 million people, followed by Syria at 6.6 and Iraq at 4.4 million. In all, 86% of the refugees under the UNHCR's mandate in 2015 were in low and middle income countries close to situations of conflict. And distressingly, children made up an astonishing 51% of the world's refugees in 2015, with many separated from their parents or traveling alone. Now, I put those stats up because at one level, I was not aware of that. At another level, the numbers are so vast that they're hard to comprehend. Picture the scale at which around the globe people are living as refugees, asylum seekers, or internally displaced people. In Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 and 17, it says there's two phrases. Jesus shared in our humanity, and Jesus had to be made like us in every way. And so as I read that article, and then I took the incident in Matthew 2, placed it alongside these two phrases from Hebrews chapter 2, I asked myself this question: does Jesus understand, does he care about the 65 million people who are refugees in the world today? And the answer to that question is absolutely yes. James 5:11 says that Jesus is full of compassion and mercy. See, Jesus understands and he cares because for a time he too was a refugee. That's why it's near and dear to his heart. So how do these qualities of Jesus, his mercy and his compassion, how do they find expression in him? And you might remember that after he was baptized and he returned from being tempted in the desert by Satan for 40 days, he went home to Nazareth And in a synagogue on one particular Sabbath day, he gave what some have titled his manifesto. He stood up and he read from the Old Testament, and he said this, in essence, this will be the focus of my ministry. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me. And look at what he would do to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And I ask the question of myself, and I ask it to you this morning, has the manifesto of Jesus changed since he spoke this one day in the synagogue at Nazareth? Has any way said, well, we're done with that, it's all fulfilled, we don't need to do that anymore? And you know the answer. It's no, that continues to be the focus of Jesus through the ministry he carries on around the world. And he told his followers when he left, Matthew 28, verse 18, he said, I want you to go into all the world and preach the good news to everyone. And then fascinating, in the book of James, as he was moved by the Spirit of God, he added this, which complemented what Jesus did all of his public ministry. He said, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. Read it with me. To look after orphans and widows in their distress. It's not one or the other, you know, go into all the world and preach the gospel and other people will go into the world and take care of the orphans. Jesus' ministry was focused on both. That's what he was talking about. And you see in what he did is he would heal bodies and minds and he would feed the hungry, but he would also share the good news of the kingdom. It wasn't one or the other, it was both. And though it's not the focus of the teaching this morning, the fact that he lived as a refugee and the implications of that is one of the ways in which this passage applies to the church of Jesus today. And I remind myself, as I remind you, Jesus cares for the weak, the poor, the disadvantaged, and the oppressed in our world. And do you know how he expresses his care? Through his church. We are the hands and feet, the voice and the presence of Jesus. And that's why you always find, if you dig deeper, go to where all the hot spots of the world where tragedy is unfolding, and you will find amongst others who've come there those who follow Jesus because he's called them to be there, or their church has supported them in going to be there, that they might be his hands, feet, voice, and presence. And so then I ask myself, so what part do we play in this? How does Jesus intend through us as a church body to be a part of expressing his care and concern for those who are displaced and who are refugees? Does Jesus want one of us to go? And it's a very real possibility that one of us would go, or a family, or a retired couple would say, you know what? We have the ability to go, and we sense the call of God on our heart that we need to go, and we as a church would stand with them as they did go. One of the things, or another way in which it might impress upon us, is we are intentionally putting into the budget for this year a yet-to-be-unnamed support for a missionary. And maybe God would be saying to us prayerfully and financially, I want you to support someone who is either going or is on site in these troubled areas of the world so they can preach the gospel and look after orphans and widows in their distress. That might be another way in which God would impress it upon us. Knowing how important compassion ministry is to Jesus is why we've created, and it's yet an unfilled position on the board, but it's called the Deacon of Compassion Ministries. We just believe that if God is calling us to be a center of radical compassion and proclamation, that we need to have someone who would get oversight to that. But we're not just going to put a warm body into that. There needs to be a sense of calling on a person who says, my heart bleeds like God bleeds for those who are suffering around the world. And I see this as a calling that I would listen to and lead the church as we fulfill ways in which we can express compassion, the compassion of Jesus in this world. And so it might be that you sense a tug on your heart as I say that, and you said, yeah, then please talk to me. We need to have coffee together and discern and pray together. It's just something that God would have you do. It's also one of the reasons why we're exploring the possibility of growing food in a garden. We don't know, but we're going to pursue it because God has tapped us on the shoulder often enough the last couple years that we have to listen and at least pursue it out as far as God leads us to pursue it out. Those are some of the ways in which the fact that he lived as a refugee connects to you and I today. Here's the third thing. As a child, Jesus fulfilled what the Lord had said in advance about him. Now, Matthew wrote, and I've put it in here, as Matthew wrote, he said that the going to Egypt was the fulfillment of what the Lord had said through the prophet Isaiah. So look at the back text, the back of the page, and I've put in there from Hosea chapter 11, verse 1 to 4. This is Hosea writing, speaking to the nation of Israel. He said, when Israel was a child, he is speaking to the nation of Israel on God's behalf. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them. Now, as we look at this, the Hosea passage, every indication as I've read that and you look at it, the Hosea passage is talking about the Exodus. I read that and I go, like, where is anything in there about the Messiah? This is looking back to the past when God brought them out, and he's using this analogy of Israel being like a little child and how he cared for them and provided for them, and how as they grew, then they turned away from him. And so it made me wonder, well, is Matthew doing, like, you know how there's some prophecy people today? You know, I remember when the United States invaded Iraq and there was a prophecy guy in our church. It's talking about Saddam Hussein right here. And I read the passage. I went, really? Because I don't see that. And so sometimes we can cherry pick what looked to be prophecies, and we plant them down in current modern-day events, and we say, that's being fulfilled. And then I think, well, is Matthew doing that? Is he sort of cherry-picking some prophecies and sort of, you know, playing willy-nilly with the Old Testament? And you come to appreciate, and that's why I also put it in the page for you so that you could see this. When you work your way through the book of Matthew, out of all the gospel writers, is very intentional and deliberate to reference things that happened in Jesus' life and how they applied to Old Testament prophecies. So we're not going to have time to read them, but I would encourage one of the things life groups may choose this week is to read each one and begin to see how Matthew referenced what was happening in Jesus' life to what happened in the Old Testament. You will be fascinated by that, but you also come away saying, there's no way Matthew cherry-picks prophecies from the Old Testament. That's not how he works. He has an incredible respect for the Scriptures. So what do we do with it? How do we understand it? When Matthew 2, verse 15, when you look, you know, you can flip over where did Matthew 2, 15 go? I didn't put it in. That's my mistake. Sorry. Matthew 2:15, we got to read it because this helps us to understand what Matthew is doing, and it's very, very significant. Matthew 2:15, it says this. They stayed there until the death of Herod, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet out of Egypt, I called my son. Now, this word fulfilled in the Greek language is pleroeo. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but neither do you. So so let's just say it's pleroeo. Okay. But what pleroeo means, it means to fill up, to complete. Now, some of the Old Testament prophecies about Messiah, they're clear, and others are just, they're a little bit more, they're harder to discern, maybe a little bit more vague. What Jesus did is he brought into light all of them. the ones that were clear, and even the ones that were in the shadows, as you could say. And what Jesus did is Jesus completed the Old Testament. Because as our kids are learning in the Gospel Project, the hero of the Old Testament is Jesus. It's his story. Every incident there is pointing ahead to him. And he completes the story. So what was Jesus completing by going to Egypt? Because that's an important question. I want to share with you a quote from Kevin DeYoung of thechristianpost.com. He says this, referencing the Hosea passage is not an example of arbitrary exegesis on the part of a New Testament writer. Jesus, as Matthew correctly understood the situation, was filling up the redemptive historical purposes of the nation of Israel. This is why Matthew so carefully drew analogies between the events of the nation's history and the historical incidents in the life of Jesus. Matthew portrays Jesus as the true and faithful Israel, the new Israel. Very, very important what Kevin DeYoung just said there. See, Hosea 11 is not a direct prophecy about Jesus going to Egypt. But Matthew sees something messianic in the fact that Jesus and his family had to flee to Egypt. When the child Jesus had to flee from Herod and went to Egypt, what this was doing was bringing it to a climax, the work of redemption and rescue that God had begun with the nation of Israel so long ago, and he was completing it when Jesus experienced his exodus out of Egypt. Do you see that? Do I need to say that again? God had started a long time ago when he delivered the nation of Israel out of Israel, out of Egypt. Jesus completed that story when he had his own exodus out of Egypt. There you see him completing the history because he stood in to do what the nation hadn't been able to do. Adam had failed, and so Abraham's family was chosen. But Abraham's family failed, and so Jesus said, I will do for humanity what none of them could do for himself. And the fact that he stepped into the story of Israel is so significant. And that's why for the rest of our lives, we will come always be learning of how the story of the Old Testament is fulfilled in the story of Jesus. See, the first Israel had broken faith with God. Jesus would be the faithful son. And what he did on behalf of the nation of Israel, he did for you and I as well. Here's the fourth thing. In the crisis of running for their lives, God was in control. Now, I do believe I have that here. And number four, it continues on. Get up, the angel said. Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. It was the paranoia and the murderous rage of Herod that caused Joseph, Mary, and Jesus to have to flee. But Herod's murderous intent did not catch God off guard. It wasn't, you know, that whatever God does in heaven, that, you know, one of the angels, have you seen what Herod's up to? And God said, oh my goodness, oh, how did that slip by me? No, not at all. God knew what Herod was up to. Who do you think directed the wise men to go to Jerusalem? I mean, you think, you know, we might be as arrogant to say, you know, God, if you just had them go straight to Bethlehem, we could have avoided all this problem. God was in control. And he directed them there, and he was aware of Herod's murderous intent. And see, this truth of the sovereignty of God, that he's in charge, it is very challenging to grasp, but grasp it we must. And it's challenging no matter how long you've walked with Jesus, because I've walked with Jesus for about 40 years now, and I'm still struggling to grasp with it. And if I was to go around the room and say, has anybody got God's sovereignty nailed and you got it clear, you fully understand it? If you put up your hand, we'd smile at you, but we go, oh, man, okay, do they really? Because it is incredibly challenging. But it makes all the difference in how we relate to God and how we live our day-to-day lives to know that He is in charge. See, when we look at these kind of things, it forces us to ask the question, and we already know the answer. We will instinctively say, well, no, He's not like that. But let me ask you something. You know, is God a puny deity? Is He just one of a whole bunch of deities out there, and He has to negotiate with other powers, say, hey, I'd like to do this, and they say, well, if you want to do that, you're going to have to give up this, and then they go into bargaining, and finally, you know, He gets it all worked out of what He wants to do. Does God somehow have that there's limits on Him? Well, you know, God, as long as you work inside the box, it's okay, but go outside of the box, no, you can't do that. Or does God's sovereignty is so puny that He has to say, listen, is it okay with you? If I would do this in your life, has anyone ever had God come to you and say, do you mind? No, that's not how God operates. You see, our understanding of His sovereignty has to be shaped by what He has revealed to us in the Word. Otherwise, we will create a God in our own image. And Job, as he wrestled through his own challenges, Job said this. As he interacted with God, who can say to the Lord, what are you doing? And yet the arrogance of our time is that so many people voice this to God. What are you doing, God? Do you really know what you're doing? Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35. This is Nebuchadnezzar. After he's been warned by God of his pride and he ignores God and he goes nuts for a while and finally his sanity is restored to him and Nebuchadnezzar is moved by the Spirit of God and he says this, the Lord does as He pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back His hand or say to Him, what have you done? And yet we've all been there if we're honest, right? Where things happen in our life, and there's a part of us that reacts, that rails against God. Some of us, we don't even like to say it, that that's what's going on inside of us. But it happens. And I'm reminded by this incident that as Jesus, as a toddler, had to flee with His family in the middle of the night, knowing there were those who were intent to murder Him, God was in charge, still in charge. And God is in charge of the entire universe. He is not answerable to anyone. No one can stop or hinder Him. His will be done. He not only created everything, He sustains everything. If He took His hand off this world, if He took His hand off your life, it's all over. That's how involved He is in our day-to-day life. Everything passes through His hands. Do you realize that? Because what can happen is stuff goes and we think, God must have been off the ticket for a while. You know, He must have been out getting a coffee. And He just looked away for a second and all this stuff came on me. No, everything passes through His hands, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And you see, we may not understand now, and that's the reality. That's where we learn to live with the tension of His sovereignty. But we may not understand how this can be, but all the circumstances of our life will ultimately glorify our great God and nothing will be wasted. And we go, and that's where we live by faith. I don't understand, God, how this is, but You say it, and so I hold on to it. I believe You ultimately will use for the good of Your glory this that is happening to us. And it's here that we're faced with the choice, because the tempter, the adversary of our souls, the dark ones, they will do their very best to whisper into us lies that will diminish God and cause us to treat God as if He's done us wrong. Or that we could doubt His faithfulness. Or if that's what faithfulness is, thank you, I'm not interested. That's the other thing that can come into mind. It may cause some of us to be cautious and tentative. You know, fool me once. You know, that's how, what's the saying? Fool me once, fool me twice, and whatever the one is. You know, if it happens to me twice, it's on me. You know, and some of us go, we're a little more cautious. Like, I stepped out for God once, and it didn't work out for me, so I'm never going to do it again. That's how it can play out in our lives. The other thing that can happen, and we've all been there was one point when my heart was broken because I had to leave Colombia and was sent to Venezuela. For 4 years, I held on to that disappointment. And if you talk to me, guess what I talked about all the time? Of course, I'd ask you, how are you, and all that kind of stuff. But I was hoping somehow the conversation would get around that I could tell you about the great wrong that was done to me when the mission moved me from Colombia to Venezuela. I dwelt on that constantly. And you know what it did? It embittered my soul. And thank God there came the day when the Spirit of God confronted me, and I had to make it right with different people. Phone calls had to be made, but I had to let go of it. Because I was living my life in the present, looking at the past. And that's what can happen. The tragedies, the disappointments, the hard things that happen to us. We get stuck there because we've lost sight of the sovereignty of God, that He can work for the good of His glory in all things in our life. Or, here's the other option. Now, I want to encourage you that we'd be a church who would do this and spur one another on this way. We can decide to press into our Savior and hold tightly onto Him when we don't have a clue of what He's doing. Or we can rest in the truth that His thoughts and ways are far above ours. And when we do that, we live with this hopeful expectancy that ultimately He will restore and He'll make all things new. We don't know how, but He will. And we believe Him because of who He is, that He will. And He gives to us this solid confidence that He's good and that He works for good in all things. See, Joseph had to flee with his family in the middle of the night from a very real danger. They had to leave home. They had to live in Egypt as refugees for an extended time. And all the while, God was in control. And I simply want to remind you, He is in control of your life. He really is. Now, our closing song, it's a declaration of what we believe to be true of God. And you'll hear these phrases as we sing, and I encourage you, one, sing it by faith. If that isn't your reality, still sing it by faith. Declare it to be true and allow the Spirit of God to speak that into your heart and grow faith in you as you do. In the sorrow, He meets us. As we wait on Him, He works, teaching us to trust. In the challenges, He's with us. His wisdom is unimagined. Though He reigns on high, He reaches down to us in endless grace. We believe He can turn for good the things that are meant for evil. God, help us, help us. To sing in faith, to pray in faith. This is what we believe to be true. You are in control. There's an incredible blessing that's spoken of in Psalm 91. I read it this morning. It says, whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. When we come to that place that we can yield to the sovereignty of God, that we understand that He doesn't have to explain to us what He's doing, but that we can trust that His heart is good, we get to rest in the shadow of the Almighty. Do you see that picture? The idea is that the Almighty God is over top of us, around us, and you and I are in the shadow of Him. Is there any better place that one could be in? To rest there. And yet our adversary Satan will do his very best to push us out of there, to cause us to question the goodness of God, to press into other things to find comfort or a solution for. And here's this promise of the blessing, that the one who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I think that's where, when we're in that place, then we can echo what Joseph said to his brothers when they feared for their lives after their dad died, thinking, oh my goodness, now comes revenge. And Joseph said, what you intended for good, for evil, God turned for good. And see, that's the response of faith that I would exhort you to live in, trusting that our sovereign God is so capable, so wise, so powerful, that He can turn all the stuff of our life, you know, the people at work who drive us nuts, the boss who doesn't understand. It's the neighbors who are crazy. You know, family members. Not you, Maurice. No, no. Sorry. Maurice is my good neighbor. All my neighbors are good. Sorry. But there's all these things, you know, the sicknesses that we're facing, the dramas in our families. God is able to turn for good all of those things when we press into Him. Go with that blessing, be encouraged. If I can pray with you, I'm just going to hang around up front, because sometimes when we get to that place where we've got to take our hands off something to let it go, to grab hold of God, you might need someone to pray with you. And if I can do that, I'll just hang around here for a little bit if that's the case. If you need an article that was up here at the front, let me know, I'll get it for you. We've also run off some more. There's another 15 copies because we ran out of the packet for next week. They'll be out at the connection desk, so you could pick one of those up. God bless you.